The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Coming to you cordless, everybody. It's 11:02 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 p.m. on the West Coast, 10:02 p.m. in Des Moines, Iowa, and 10:02 p.m. also in the Central Time Zone where I'm sitting here in downtown Minneapolis. I'm Jim Peters, and welcome to the 72nd edition of Jim Peters Tonight. Got a little rear clip there once again. I don't know why. God damn. All right, so I got to tell you, I just walked away from the television. When I was working at Kong News, we actually had a TV set that I would watch with the sound off. And right now I got three monitors here, and I don't have any television. But I just walked away from the TV. Trump was just about to start. Now, if you've been following this, so they called, both AP and Fox News called the Iowa caucuses three minutes after they ended. At 8:03 p.m. Central. And Trump is a runaway winner. As a matter of fact, it does look like he's going to get more than 50% of the vote. He has been, since they called it, he's been waffling between 51 and 53%. Fox News just announced when I walked away from the television that they've called him for 97 out of the 99 Iowa counties, and it looks like he will win the last two too. They're not actually calling that yet, but there's a good possibility that Donald Trump will win every single county, which was not really. I mean, there were some counties that pretty much thought Nikki Haley was going to take, especially the suburban counties around Des Moines. But it looks like he's going to do it. Anyway, so yeah, so I think Trump was just about to speak before I walked away from the TV, so I haven't seen it. So anyway, and yeah, we do this live. I know, it's fucking amazing technology. So let me tell you what we got going on here. I'm not going to do this really quick. We got announcements. We all have announcements. First of all, our show is sponsored by Conk News at conk.com. That's Conk News. Conk at conk.com, the single best conservative news aggregator on the internet, period. You check this out. Later on in the show, we'll talk about it a little more in detail. But yeah, they do the very great, good job. I'm going to show you in about 20 minutes the front page I pulled up from Conk in real time. And they're talking about the Iowa caucuses too. So they got that going on. What else we got? So, oh, tonight. What am I doing? Tonight, our guest, Murray Sabrin, economist extraordinaire. He was supposed to be on last Wednesday. We had to kill our show last Wednesday. We canceled at the very last minute. I'm going to explain this again. We share the studio with another company, and that's really easy to do because they basically keep more or less business hours, and we don't come in here until 9 p.m. Central to start this at 10 o'clock. Well, my agreement with them is that if they have some sort of emergency where they have to do something at 10 o'clock, I abdicate. And we came in here at 9, and 5 minutes later on Wednesday, they were in here and said, sorry, Jim, we got to do this. And so I had to make a decision very quickly to cancel and called Murray on the phone. And I said, well, you doing anything on Monday? He said, no, so he's coming on. So we got Murray. We're going to talk about. We got a lot of stuff to talk about with Murray. Now he explains this all to you and us and me in relatively simple terms. The economy is a very complicated thing, but the big thing we want to ask him is that he's been predicting a recession for 2024 for about 3 years now, And there's a lot of people thinking it's going to happen, so I kind of want to pin them down on this. And also, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on, too. That's tonight. Tomorrow night, David Strom, our longtime friend here from Minneapolis. You know, I've talked about this. David works here in Minneapolis for hotair.com with me. I've never met him in the flesh. We've been talking for years. Sooner or later, we're going to go out for a drink. I know that, but it hasn't happened yet. So he's across town. He's about 5 miles away from me, and he's going to be joining us via the internet smartphone. And we're going to talk about what he's got going on. He's the associate editor of hotair.com. It's Tuesday, if I'm right. Next Tuesday, a week after he's on, his boss, Ed Morrissey, the editor-in-chief of hotair.com, is going to be on air. So it's like three people from Hot Air. Jazz Shaw was on last week, too. And why? Because Hot Air is great. And they don't pay me. They're not a sponsor. It just is. It's a great, great publication. Matter of fact, I highly recommend all the Salem media websites. And that's where they're mostly under the townhall.com banner. I think there's like six of them. PJ Media, Red State, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell. She's coming on next, on Wednesday. What am I talking about? She's going to be here on Wednesday. She writes for Red State that we called them the dynamic duo. She comes on with Jeff Meyer, the CEO and publisher of Conk News, and they come on together, and they riff off each other. They kind of like that. It's like they work spouses or something, you know, whatever. Yeah. Thursday night, Wake the Kids. This is really big. We got the Stan Gordon, the legendary UFO researcher. He's going to be joining us, and he said he's willing to talk for at least an hour. Normally, I'd welcome that, except he also there's not going to be a picture. He's doing audio only, so we might do an hour. I don't think we'll do more than that because there's nothing to look at, unfortunately. But yeah, so he's going to be here. Now, his claim to fame is that he lived in Kecksburg. He was 17 years old when the thingy, whatever it was, crashed in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, December 1965. He was actually there when it happened. So if you don't know about this, what happened is this thing crashed in Kecksburg. It's a tiny little town about 50 miles west of Pittsburgh, if I'm right. The U.S. Army said, the U.S. government said it was a meteor, but at least two dozen people in town actually saw it and said, no, it was a spacecraft. And the U.S. government put it on a flatbed truck and put a tarp over it and hauled it away. And there are plenty of witnesses, and he got started in this whole thing from that. Now he's branched off. Matter of fact, he told me he wanted to make a point that I asked him about the Bigfoot stuff, because he's become more of a Bigfoot researcher than UFOs, it appears. So anyway, we're going to have a wonderful conversation with him. We had to book this months in advance. That's how in demand this guy is. So I'm really, really happy he agreed to do it. I'm looking forward to talking to him. Next week, we got, like I said, Ed Morrissey. On Wednesday, Albert Rosales, who's written 15 books called A Series Humanoid Creatures. So the deal is, they're not necessarily extraterrestrials or gray aliens or whatever. They're anything that basically walks upright on 2 feet and kind of looks like humans but isn't. And there's way more than just the stupid gray aliens here involved here. And Bigfoot goes into this too. And then you get the Wingman, and you get the Mothman, and you get the lizard people, all sorts of and shit. This is all based on personal testimony. People have said they've seen this stuff. You know, yeah, okay, some of them may not be true, right? Okay, but, I mean, 15 books? Seriously, I mean, I'm reading the last one, which he says is the last one he's ever going to put out. And they're done chronologically. This one's from stories from 2000 to 2015, and I'm in the process of reading it now. Gotta say, pretty damn interesting, some of those stories, pretty cool. He's on Wednesday. On Thursday, Mark Marcel is joining us, and he was named by Bigfoot Times as a Bigfoot Researcher of the Year, or they call them the Bigfooter of the Year. And David Perez, the editor of the Bigfoot Times, has been on the show, and I get that. I really love this, because the Bigfoot Times is sent through snail mail. It's not an email publication. It's not an online publication. It's actually a four-page thing they send through the mail. It really is, and I love it because it's so old school. I like reading paper. I love it. So at any rate, I get my Bigfoot Times, and I called Daniel and said, can I have this guy on my show? He said, you betcha, and they arranged for it. So I'm really happy about that, too. So tonight, now, I mentioned this like the last couple of weeks. This is show number 72 here. You know, we take phone calls. We took video phone calls. Talkers Magazine says this, we're the first talk show in America to take live video phone calls. And you can call us on your phone, your camera phone, or on your desktop or whatever, you know, got a camera and a mic. You go to jimatnight.com/call. It's this address right here. And press a big blue button at the top of the screen, and you're in the queue. It's really, really simple. I've asked everybody who calls. It's simpler than making a FaceTime call. No lie. It actually is. So that's all you got to do. But here's the deal. Since Murray's coming on tonight, and we got a lot of questions for him, now we are monitoring, and let me actually turn this thing on, we are monitoring text messages in real time while the show is going on. So you see this number right here? 408-458-5088. You can remember that. 408-458-5088. You can send a text message to that number, and I will see it instantaneously. This is particularly good when we have live guests, and Murray will be live tonight. He'll be coming on in about, let me see, about 10-15 minutes. And you can say, if you have questions for Murray, text them in. Okay? That's the way this goes here. All right. So I have to bitch about the weather because those of you who've been following the news today, you know, it's like ridiculously cold in Iowa. And of course, Iowa is just not south of us. Des Moines is a 5-hour drive from Minneapolis. And it's a little better here, but not much. It was not, we actually did crack zero today. I mean, I think the high was 3 above. We were not supposed to. The projected high, the forecast high was 2 below, I think. But seriously, if you've ever been in this neck of the woods, anything below zero just freaking sucks. It's awful. And down in Des Moines, apparently it was 16 below, you know. Now, it's astonishing how many people showed up for those caucuses. I mean, I guess they got the full crowd of what they were expecting. About 150,000 people showed up. And especially because a lot of them are in rural areas where the roads aren't plowed very well and the wind blows really badly. I mean, the wind chill in Des Moines was 25 below. It was only like, you know, right now, I checked just before we came on. It's 3 below here right now. But the wind chill here has been about 25 below all day long. It's been blowing pretty hard. And, of course, we're in the middle of the city. So it's like you need a lot of wind to actually get real wind because of the buildings and stuff. So it was a miserable day today. I overslept. Brittany was supposed to cut my hair around 1 o'clock. I called her. We canceled. It's like, Jesus, now I'm going to have a haircut on Wednesday. So I'm going to her salon. Usually I go to her house. I know that I've known this woman for years. So I go to her house and she cuts my hair, but I'm actually going to go to her salon on Wednesday, which is in Plymouth. So like you care. but it's in the western suburbs. But yeah, so I called, say, we're not, you know, and she has her car, which I call the lesbian falcon. what did she call it? She calls it the Lesbaru. Do I have to tell you what brand this is? She's not a lesbian, by the way, but, you know, it's a brand of car that is highly favored by homosexuals. So of course I got to tease her about that, and she teases herself. But at any rate, yeah. So I have not left the house other than to take the trash out 20 yards in my backyard. God damn it! I mean, really, seriously. And then you know you wonder, why do you live here? What's the point? You know, I went to school in Miami. I mean, shit, I lived for years in Los Angeles. Los Angeles, Southern California, and Italy, best weather in the world. No doubt about it. I mean, not too hot, not too cold. Just fantastic. Mediterranean climate, you know? And San Diego is even better than L.A., even though it's only a couple hours south. But still, it is, you know? You want a place to live where the weather's wonderful? Go there. Well, I was, and then I what the fuck? I came here. Jesus Christ. Okay, so here's my takeaway from this from these caucuses. It is astonishing for all the shit, you know, 91 counts, six different trials, you know, that Donald Trump has gotten. Everyone seems to see through it. And then today, the New York Times ran an op-ed. They wrote it. It was an editorial on the editorial page where they basically begged the public, the Republicans, not to vote for Trump. They said he is a unique danger to democracy. Oh, shut the fuck up. He is not. He's already done this. How far do they think that they got nothing? This is the problem. This is their problem. They got nothing. You know, okay, so, you know, Trump had a pretty good first term, and then supposedly Biden beat him because he was so disliked, even though apparently the latest poll I saw, which was this morning, the poll that said 68% of Americans, I actually don't know if it's Americans or Republicans, 68% of those people, one or the other, and let's say it's Republicans. Although the last time I saw, over 50% of the public, the entirely Americans, think that the Democrats cheated the 2020 election. And I'm, you know, they're saying, well, you know, you're just an election denier. Yeah. Here's the deal. I've said this a million times. I don't have proof, but I have evidence. There was enough evidence so that an investigation should have been done. There's no doubt about that. So, okay. So, but all this stuff that Trump has gone through all these years, and people don't buy any of it. At least the Republicans don't. Now, supposedly, Laura Ingraham on Fox News and what was it, Dana Perino or somebody else was saying that they were out at the caucuses tonight, and there were a lot of Democrats that came and registered as Republicans to vote for Haley. That is what the scuttlebutt is, and it didn't work. It appears Trump is going to win every single county in Iowa. Right now, he's won all but two. So that strategy is not going to work for the Democrats. I mean, it's really amazing. I actually don't know. I got to admit, I have not been following this enough to know if Haley is really the establishment candidate that everyone's trying to paint her as. But apparently, I mean, the Democrats think so. They want, you know, they think that she's the obvious alternate choice. And then the amazing thing is, if you've been watching this the last 2 hours, it appears, it's really close, but it appears that DeSantis is going to come in second. Also, it appears that, you know, everyone's saying how much farther can Trump get above 50%. It appears that his vote count has been wavering between 51 and 53%. And the last time I saw, 80% of the votes were in. So it appears that he will break 50%, which means that there's 40 delegates available to the Republican convention in Iowa, and they're distributed proportionally. So if he breaks 50%, that means he'll take 51 and maybe 52, or I'm sorry, no, 21 or 22 of out of 40. He will get at least half of them. But the real story I look at this is that for all the bullshit and all the constant pounding by the mainstream media about the fact that this guy's evil, there's a whole shitload of Americans that don't buy it at all. Surveys done today at the caucuses, the vast majority of Republicans in Iowa think that all this the charges against Trump are political. They don't buy it. They don't believe in any of it. They don't buy any of it. I'm kind of fascinated by this. People are getting really smart, you know, and this is maybe the first time ever in American history. First of all, it's only until recently that people didn't even trust their government. When did that start? Probably Watergate, you know, 1974. In 1973, 1974, people started realizing, oh my God, they actually lied to us. You know, I read an interesting quote from William Colby, and I was going to actually put this in my show notes. I can't remember, so I'm paraphrasing here, where he said, there's no significant person in the mainstream media that the CIA does not own. That's maybe a paraphrase of that quote. He was the director of the CIA for like 3 years under Bush Sr. So, and yeah, that's what's going, you know, I mean, I look at stuff that ends up in the mainstream media, and I know, I mean, this is how long I've been doing this, folks, and this is how cynical I've gotten at this point. I look at stuff that's written in the mainstream media, and I know for a fact that some reporter was paid to write it by somebody, either like the Democratic National Committee or the CIA. And isn't this terrible that we have government or the DOJ or, you know, the government, the bureaucratic state of America is entirely against conservatives. They're entirely liberal too. And I just find it, and yet for all that pounding, banga, banga, bang, I mean, daily, you know, Trump colluded with Russia. Trump peed on cookers. You know, it's like whatever you go, it goes on and on and on, and nobody buys it. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, but a whole bunch of people don't. I'm starting to think now. I didn't want to make this prediction until, you know, I guess I don't want to make it now too, but I'm going to. I mean, I'm starting to think that I don't know if it matters. You know, there's still people. I mean, there's still a whole bunch of people that say that. But Biden is eventually going to drop out of the race. I mean, on both sides, there's, you know, Karl Rove just said it on television about a half an hour ago. I mean, there's a lot of people who think he is actually not going to run for the presidency again. But that's interesting because as time goes on here, it's going to get harder and harder and harder for him to actually drop out because then they need a replacement. And who would that be? Well, I mean, it appears obvious it's going to be Gavin Newsom, but Trump will destroy Newsom even more than Biden. That's what I think. That's my point here. I think Trump right now is the odds on favorite to win the election. And I don't know if it matters who he runs against. Matter of fact, I think he might have a better chance running against anybody but Biden, which is weird, but because you look at Biden, and what we have here is the single most incompetent president in the modern era. The modern era, let's say, starts in 1960. You know, and I mean, this makes Jimmy Carter look like brilliant crap. And here's, you know, Jimmy Carter was brilliant as a man. He was a very, very intelligent guy. You know, he had the perfect credentials for being president. He actually did. Not only had he been governor of Georgia successfully, he owned a very large business. He was an entrepreneur. As far as I know, to this day, Carter Farms still processes more peanuts than any other company in the United States. I mean, he was a self-made, wealthy man. He was a freaking nuclear physicist in the Navy. He ran the engines that ran the nuclear aircraft carriers and the submarines. I mean, the guy had everything going for him in spades. Now, why did his presidency fail? It was partly circumstances, but also, I mean, you do have to make a point. He made some really bad decisions. He did. So, I mean, so it's not entirely, it wasn't entirely hands off, you know, that, you know, he did have something to do with it. But, and I've said this before, the thing with Carter is that Carter knew things weren't going well. He acknowledged it. He constantly, matter of fact, it was almost annoying how much he talked about it, but he knew things were going bad. You know, I got a quote here about Biden. I was going to bring this up by Murray, and we're going to put Murray on in just a second here. So Corinne Jean-Pierre said this about Bidenomics. She said, this is a quote from yesterday from the press conference, the White House press conference. Look, we understand what American people went through these past 3 years, right? We came out of the pandemic, right? A pandemic we hadn't seen in 100 years. And when the president walked in, the economy was upside down. No, it wasn't. It was not. That's a lie. You turned the economy upside down. The economy was doing relatively well considering the fact we were having a pandemic, and it had been doing stellar for 3 years before that. That's bullshit. And that's the thing. They keep gaslighting us and telling us this bullshit. This is crap. You know, I can't tell you how much this upsets me. But my point here, you know, so, you know, compared to Carter, Biden is just a doofus. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, and then, you get and all this crap that the press has been feeding the American public for like 6-7 years now, and it's amazing. It's obvious now. There's a whole bunch of people that simply don't buy it. Not a few, a bunch. So before we put Murray on, I want to tell you about Conk News. Here we go. Here this is the oh God. All right, come on. Hold on. This happened before too. There we go. That's the front page of Conk News that I pulled up about a half an hour ago. But you already see it says there in the top of the center column breaking, Donald Trump projected to win the Iowa caucus. This thing updates. Conk News updates every 3 hours. Now, they do very little original recording. Reporting. They do a little, but that's not what this is about. This is a news aggregator. They have servers and algorithms that scan 75 different news sources every 3 hours and pulls headlines and photos. All these photos are actually from the stories that on those websites, and create a page that's listed in roughly chronological order from and mix and matches these stories. That's what it does. So it's not like you have, you know, five stories from one thing and five stories from another. They're all intertwined depending on the time they were put out. So, I mean, I don't know if I can scroll this, but you can't see my, like, for example, here on the, in the left-hand column here, this is from hotair.com. We can tell by the little, I'm using my cursor and you can't see it. So, that's from hotair.com. The next story below it is from the National Review. And the next story below that is from Hot Air again. So that's the way this works. If you're a news junkie, you can't find a better news source. I mean, you can spend 2-3 hours reading this page, this one page, the front page of their website, and then it all changes every 3 hours. It updates 8 times a day, every 3 hours. So, if you're looking for a news source, you can't find anything better than this. And we're happy as hell. They're my former employer. I used to be the editor-in-chief there. I'm happy. I'm proud of my association with this place. And really, seriously, there's no better news source in America than Conk News. You should check this out. It's at conk.com, conk.com. All right, Murray's here, and we're going to play a little 12-second bumper music here, and then we'll talk to him. Here we go. Hey, Murray, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Jim. Great to be with you. How's the weather up your way?
Oh, God. Well, you missed the beginning of the show. I've been bitching about it and bitching about it. You've heard about Des Moines. It's only slightly better here, but that's not saying much. So
yeah, well, we're in Southwest Florida. It's now 71 degrees. Yeah. But it's been really cloudy the last 2 weeks.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's terrible. I mean, and the heat went on the other day for the first time.
No. Holy shit. That's awful. Yeah. Do you miss New Jersey then?
Not one bit. I mean, it would take a lot of horses to drag me back to New Jersey.
And forgive me.
The weather has been awful up north. I mean,
yes, it has. Murray, you're in Naples, right?
We're in Naples.
Right, good.
It really is a magnet for people all over the country and around the world. You see people from Europe, Canada, people just love the area. It's getting very crowded now compared to a few years ago. We've been here almost a year and a half now, and I wouldn't trade it for any place because we're in a very convenient location in terms of shopping. I-75 is not far away. If we want to take a trip down to Florida, up to Tampa, even go up to Disney World, take 75 to Route 4. It's a very convenient location. The airport is a half hour away. So it has all the things we were looking for when we decided to move to Florida. Our first location was in Fort Myers, but that didn't work out for us. And so we came down here, and one of my former colleagues from Ramapo College is in the development, and he told me about it. So we took a look at it in August of 22, and we decided to move in, and we did in October of 22.
God bless you. I went to school in Miami. I don't know if I ever told you that.
Oh, no.
University of Miami. So why did I leave there? Actually, Murray, let me tell you the story. This is well known now. I don't remember the exact day. I was in Miami in January 1977, supposedly the only day it snowed in Miami ever. And it snowed about a quarter of an inch at 5 o'clock in the morning. But that completely shut the whole city down. I mean, nobody knew how to deal with it. So I'm walking across campus. I'm like 22 years old. I was a big tennis player. I got my stupid little 1970s short tennis shorts on and my little, little polo shirt on and walking across campus. It's like 10 a.m. It's about 40, 50 degrees. And this co-ed, she's wearing a full-length mink coat. And she comes down the path, and she stops me, and she says, and honestly, well, I can say this here. She says, she didn't even stop to say hello. She says, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "It's cold as fuck out here." What? She said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Minneapolis." And she said, "Oh," and then she just kept on walking.
Well, for Minneapolis, if it's 40, 50 degrees in January, that's pretty good temperature.
That's right. That's right. It was fine. I had no problem with it. I got my shorts on, but she did. I'm astonished. If you meet Florida natives, some of them have never seen snow ever. You know, I don't know if you've ever met these people, but they exist. I know that. I met them.
Oh, there's no question about it. And where we are, it rarely snows. I mean, we're just northwest of Miami. And 2 years ago, 2 winters ago, I think it got into the upper 30s, low 40s. And that was kind of nippy in the morning when you had to go out and run some errands. But otherwise, it hit 80 degrees today, but there's not much sun. I mean, this is supposed to be the dry season. We've had so much rain in the last 3 weeks. It's just astonishing that the weather patterns, and this is what weather is all about. It's not totally consistent year in and year out. There'll be hot times. There'll be cool times. There'll be wet when you think it's dry. It'll be dry when it's wet. We had a very dry summer last summer compared to the averages. And
Murray, I know you.
What it's all about. It's quite random and it's variable.
That's right. You're not going to say climate change, are you?
No.
No, it's not. It's weather. It's just plain weather.
Weather is not climate.
Then. No, it isn't. It is. Thank you very much. Thank you. So, did you watch any? Have you been watching the Iowa coverage the latter from this evening?
Yeah, I just heard that Ramaswamy is suspending his campaign.
Oh, I've been on here, so I've not heard that. So
yeah, he's suspended. I just have to check my eye out. Yeah, all of a sudden it got very very uncomfortable.
It happens to me too. It's live TV.
Yeah, so he suspended his campaign, so it'll be just Trump, Haley, and DeSantis. DeSantis finished second, it looks like. He's over 2 percentage points ahead of Haley. So I guess that hurts her because she was expecting a pretty decent finish.
Yeah.
And I guess her expectation is she'll do well in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And then go to her home state of South Carolina. So this thing is pretty much a done deal since Trump got 51%, I see here on the TV, which is not bad for a former president. I think the expectation was he would break 50%. So if he breaks 50%, he can declare a huge victory. Since,
right.
Well, he's 30 points ahead of DeSantis.
Just before I started here, Fox News was saying it looks like he was going to win every single county, too.
That's a probability.
Yeah.
The point is, what is he going to propose in terms of actual policy that's going to make the country better? And we know that these endless wars, this involvement overseas is perpetuating these wars. And if he wants to be the peacemaker and he can run as the peacemaker, I think that would be fantastic that he runs as the peacemaker saying, listen, these wars do not serve anyone's interest. The death and destruction are just so widespread. And we have to live in a world where we can trade with each other. We can, people can fulfill their potential, especially young people, and get back to rebuilding Ukraine, of course, with private capital, not with government taxpayer money, and have a truce between Ukraine and Russia, and of course the intractable situation in Israel and Gaza has to be really addressed, because this could spiral out of control very easily.
Well, let me ask you, Murray. I mean, it looks like in the last week it's starting to spiral. I mean, there's already people talking about the fact we might be heading to World War III, and I'm not talking about this in any sort of like, you know, distant way. I mean, the last week we got the Houthis, and then you got Iran starting to apparently directly, you know, bombing stuff, and it's like, you know, this could all completely unravel very, very quickly, don't you think?
Well, that's why there are always tripwires when you have countries engaged in a war. Here, you don't have a country. You basically have a Gaza. It's certainly not a country in terms of what we usually think of countries. But Israel is surrounded by inhospitable neighbors, and they have to come to a rapprochement with these countries. And they were starting to do it with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
and that's when all hell broke loose in Gaza and Israel. So I think the Saudis want peace. The Egyptians want peace. I think the Syrians want peace desperately. And and Jordan also, since they border Israel. And Iran is apparently is causing some problems in the area because of their geopolitical goals. So again, as I pointed out tonight, I spoke at a Martin Luther King event here at our independent living facility, and I said he's remembered for his civil rights activism, but what he should be also remembered for is his anti-war positions against the Vietnam War. And I quoted from his speech that he gave exactly a year before he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, and the speech he gave in Riverside Church in Manhattan, attended by more than 3,000 people. And the title of it is Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And he was relatively quiet during the buildup from 65 to 67. And then he realized he's got to speak out against this war, because it's sending black young men to fight in parts of the world where in the States they weren't treated very hospitably because of the racial tension in the country. And so he started questioning this whole concept of using military intervention overseas, because it wasn't the Christian way, and he was a reverend. And so I think he came to the conclusion that U.S. military involvement overseas in third world countries was poisoning America, and he was right. Look at it. It's nearly 60 years later since he gave that speech, and look what we're involved in. Look where we have been involved in Iraq, Afghanistan. How has that served not only the people in those countries? How has it served the American people?
Well, it was pointless.
We borrowed trillions of dollars to fight these wars,
right,
based upon lies. The so-called weapons of mass destruction were never in Iraq, and Iraq is a third world country. For it to be for people to claim that it was a threat against the United States is really disingenuous. And this is why people like General Smedley Butler, who talked about this 100 years ago, who wrote War is a Racket, Ron Paul in his two presidential campaigns in 2008 and 2012, Howard Buffett, the father of Warren Buffett, made a passionate statement that we cannot export democracy to the rest of the world. We don't have the money or the wherewithal to do so. And we should just be friends with people around the world. This is what Thomas Jefferson believed in. That's what George Washington said in his farewell address. Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address, January 1961, said we have to be aware of the military-industrial complex. They have too much power.
Yeah.
And of course, the famous speech 5 months before he was assassinated, John Kennedy, at the commencement address at American University in June of 1963, said, "We have to have a peaceful coexistence with the Soviet Union. Otherwise, we're going to blow up each other."
Right.
And of course, the military-industrial complex didn't want to hear that message.
Right.
Neither did the military-industrial complex and the Soviet Union. He was assassinated. Kennedy was assassinated in November 63. And a year later, Khrushchev is ousted in the Soviet Union, who made an arrangement to get the missiles out of Cuba in 1962. And that really began a process, I think, where both leaders were ousted because they wanted to have peace between the two countries.
Right, right. And the thing with Eisenhower is that, I mean, it goes without saying, he was a five-star general, and he stood up on TV and said, yeah, we have to be aware of the careful about the military-industrial complex. It's actually, when you stop and think about it, it's shocking that a guy in that position would actually say that, you know. So he must have, he meant it.
He was in the military all his adult life.
Yeah.
He saw it as president, and unfortunately, he allowed John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, to run foreign policy. And as you know, Jim, Vietnam was supposed to have free and open elections in 1964, according to the Geneva Conference. And the United States scuttled that election, which would have meant the election of Ho Chi Minh and won Vietnam. And we would never have gotten involved in Vietnam. And so the United States was responsible for the division in Vietnam between North and South, and then the Johnson buildup that led to 58,000 deaths in Vietnam, and God knows how many Vietnamese, Cambodians, Laotians in that part of the world. And so the history of American foreign policy is a total disaster.
Yes, it is.
Spanish-American War, go back to the Mexican-American War, and it's been a total disaster.
Hey, Murray.
Unnecessary killing and destruction.
Let me ask you. So that whole thing about the domino theory during the Vietnam War, do you think that that Nixon and the people in American government actually believed it, or was it just a ruse to continue the war?
Well, it was a ruse. It was pure propaganda. It didn't make any sense because these countries are run by nationalists. Ho Chi Minh was a nationalist. In fact, in 1945, he modeled the constitution that he wanted to implement in Vietnam on the Declaration of Independence. In other words, he quoted the saying that there's nothing more important than freedom and independence. I mean, that's right out of the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And so the United States policymakers made mistakes on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, and they really turned a nation that was a beautiful nation that wanted to have sovereignty after the French colonial rule, and the United States was supporting the French, paying 80% of their military expenses in Vietnam. And that's, I think, one of the blights of the Eisenhower administration, is that they didn't allow Vietnam to be unified, and we never would have gotten involved.
So I want to get on to the economic stuff here. I have a friend of mine who's in finance who watched your last, you haven't been on, I think, maybe about 8 weeks, who watched your last appearance. And since you were on last, I probably don't have to tell you this, you know, for the last year or two, the majority of economists have basically agreed with you that at some point in 2024, there's going to be a major recession. Now, a lot of them are backtracking. My friend says, she said, I'm not going to name him, but he said, you got to tell Murray this, that I think Murray's nuts. he said that to me. I mean, a lot of people think that the soft landing is going to stick. Now, I got to tell you, my thing is, we've printed so much fake money that I can't, at this point, I can't see something bad not happening. So where are you now? Where are you on this right now?
Well, I in December of 2021, which is over 2 years ago, I said, we're going to have a recession probably, given the data and the that we had at that point, by the end of 2023. And of course, here we are in the beginning of 2024, and there hasn't been any official recession, but there are indications that companies are starting to lay off in a much bigger way than they have in the past year. And that is the beginning of the restructuring, or I should say the readjustment of the economy to all the cheap interest rates that we've had for several years. This process doesn't happen overnight. It takes time to unfold. People are still using their savings from COVID, and buying up a lot of stuff, and credit card debt has gone through the roof.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
And so we know people are living paycheck to paycheck. This is not a healthy economy.
No, it's not.
Even though the unemployment rate is officially under 4%, but I think that those, and we saw that the Bureau of Labor Statistics just reported that they overstated the number of new jobs last year by nearly 500,000.
That's right.
So, how do we know that data are accurate? That
exactly.
What the government is telling us about everything is wonderful with Bidenomics is in fact a myth.
As a matter of fact, the way I understand this, Murray, in the last 30 months, they have overestimated the job creation numbers 29 out of 30 times.
Yeah.
So
it just shows you that the methodology is not great. I don't believe they're deliberately falsifying the data.
I was going to ask you that. Okay, so that's cool.
Yeah, I don't believe that at all. But the point is, all you have to do is speak to business people. I mean, you have bankers like Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, who's pretty pessimistic about the economy.
Yeah.
A lot of savvy hedge fund managers that see things that are happening because they're looking at companies and see exactly what the revenue and the expenses are and the profit margins, and they don't see very good things happening. And historically, the data show when the Fed starts cutting interest rates, that's when the recession really takes off because the Fed is worried that there's not going to be enough liquidity in the economy for the corporate sector.
And I actually put it in my notes that Jamie Dimon agrees with you that he thinks the same thing. And I think we talked about this on the phone. I can't remember about the fact that now Harry Dent, he's come out saying that it's not just going to be a recession. He thinks the whole economy is going to freaking collapse. I mean,
Yeah, that's a tough call to make of a real big collapse. In fact, I think if the economy has this downturn in 2024, which is not going to be great for Biden's reelection, if in fact he's the nominee, I think all the things that are going to come together to give us a major economic crisis will be at the end of this decade. So that's 4 or 5 years from now, 6 years from now, because all the analysis I've done in terms of the cycles that we've experienced for 200 years suggests that things are going to get very dicey because the debt is out of control. The interest on the debt is skyrocketing. Military expenditures are skyrocketing. And government spending in general is at the highest level, I think, in decades. When government spending is at these levels, the economy tends to slow down dramatically because the government is sucking money out of the private sector to pay for all these welfare programs and the military-industrial complex, which are what? Non-productive.
Yeah, they don't
increase the supply of goods and services that the American people want. So, again, I could be wrong, which, of course, there's nothing wrong with being wrong.
No.
It just means that...
I will still love you just as much.
The data that we have reveals to me that the economy is slowing down. And the way companies, I understand how companies operate their businesses. Companies are very hesitant to lay off people right before Christmas. And so they keep people on, and then they decide how many employees do I really need for 2024, given what I see unfolding in terms of demand for my products, the state of the economy, if they even bother to look at that, and say, what tactical decisions do we have to make now in order for us to keep our heads above water in 2024 and in 2025?
And you know that, and that brings me to artificial intelligence. Now, this may not seem like a reasonable segue, but it actually is, because it's plainly obvious to me, and this is not going to happen next week, but over the course of time here, that being a few years, that AI is going to very quickly put large numbers of people out of work. It's literally going to take jobs. I foresee this is maybe 20 to 30 years from now, where actually there's only jobs for like half of the people in America, and the rest of it will be done by machines and computers. Do you have any thoughts on this, or?
It's something I haven't done a deep dive on yet. I mean, it's really hard to project 20, 30 years out in terms of what the job market's going to look like. But every time you have a new industry, there are always people saying that it's going to cause jobs to shrink. Well, look what's happened in the last 75 years since the end of World War II. The population has grown. Technology has improved. And there are more jobs than ever. And of course, there are, what, 9 million unfilled jobs in the country.
Yeah.
There's always work to be done. And the amazing thing about the U.S. economy, Jim, and the research I've done, is entrepreneurs are incredibly creative. And there are things going on in this economy right now that will bear fruit 5, 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah.
So if you're take a long range view, a long-term view of the economy, you have to be optimistic. And that's one of the things that Warren Buffett keeps on stating in his letters to shareholders every year, what they issue at a report, is that he goes back to the 1930s and 40s, and look what he's seen in his lifetime in terms of technology, automobiles, housing, medical care, medical technology. And it's just going to get better and better, not because of the government. I would say in spite of the government, because the men and women entrepreneurs, they are the real heroes in America, not the people on Capitol Hill who put roadblocks.
Well, of course not. They don't do anything.
Entrepreneurship.
Right.
So again, we have to free up the economy, get rid of most of the regulations that are out there, cut spending, cut taxes, and the Fed has to stop manipulating interest rates, and we'll have sustainable prosperity.
So the reason I'm sounding so pessimistic, and you have to tell, I always forget there's a term for this. I can't remember what it is, about the fact that you're right. There's a transference of jobs when things change, and like an example is like bank tellers are put out of business by ATMs, but on the other hand, you need people to maintain the ATMs. So pretty much, the number of jobs doesn't really change. The thing that scares me about AI, and when I say AI, I'm talking about the whole basically robotics thing, is once we get to the point where robots can build other robots, when you literally have second generation robots. At that point, I think things fundamentally change based on what previously. Do you know what I mean?
I get it. But the point is, look at the telecommunications industry. No more operators. There used to be a ton of operators in this country when you had to make a long distance phone call.
Yeah,
then,
right.
Then we had direct dial. Now you don't have telephone books anymore. You used to have telephone books. We don't have those things. There are a whole bunch of industries that have disappeared. Car companies have disappeared. You just go on and on. Medical technology is advancing at a very rapid rate. I'm not talking about the pharmaceuticals. I'm talking about actual procedures for operations and things like that. So those are advancing. We're a knowledge-based society. Farming is going to be very important in the future. As we have more mouths to feed around the world, we're going to need more and more productive farms out there. So there's going to be people involved in the science and research growing food, and then you need distribution, you need trucking, and the infrastructure. So there's never a lack of work to be done by people, and that's I think the beauty of the free enterprise economy is that there is always work to be done. We're going to need plumbers, electricians, you name it, people in the trades, automobile mechanics, for goodness sakes. And these are high-paying jobs. These are six-figure jobs that pay.
And they're paying more all the time, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have a college degree today to make a decent living. It's people associate college degrees with having a prestigious job, but people find fulfillment in plumbing, electrician, roofing, landscaping here in Florida. I mean, goodness, you see HVAC trucks are all over the place. So, again, I would not be very pessimistic about the economy, and it's just a matter of seeing this thing unfold. We're living through it in real time, and like I said, in my lifetime, things have changed. Phonographs, cassettes, they're no longer around.
Yeah.
You have an incredible way of getting music now, and streaming channels. So these things are constantly evolving, and I don't foresee a problem. I may be wrong, but I just don't see a problem, because look at the evolution of the American economy for the past 200 years, and it's just remarkable how many industries have disappeared, how many new jobs have been created, how many new industries have been created because of the computer chip and the internet, how many jobs are related to the internet these days, and Like I say, I'm optimistic long term. I'm pessimistic about what government keeps on doing. I mean, they're the ones that are undermining prosperity with taxes and regulations. And of course, a big thing, if Trump gets in, he's a high tariff guy, and we know tariffs are economic destructive policies. So tariffs throughout American history have caused a lot of tension, not only here, but around the world. In fact, there's an argument that has been made that tariffs that were imposed in the 1930s to help countries get out of the Great Depression was one of the main triggers for World War II. So there's a lot of history about how tariffs are really harmful to not only the domestic economy, but create conflict around the world.
Murray, can tariffs work on a real short-term basis, like, a year or two? Is that
No, because they have no socially or economically redeeming value. All they do is benefit some people at the expense of others. And that's why each regulation has its beneficiaries and its losers. And so we want to have an economy where everyone wins. And through the natural order of things, look how many car companies are no longer with us. Look how many airlines are no longer with us. So people find other jobs, that people use their skills, whatever they have, to get other careers. And people have been building up businesses on the internet. It's just amazing how many people have multi-million-dollar industries on the internet.
Yeah, I was just talking to a
So
friend of mine. My friend was saying that I kind of don't understand either. I don't understand how even charging people $120 a year, how Amazon can give away free shipping and still make money. I gotta admit, I don't see how they do it.
it's an amazing business model, and you got to give Jeff Bezos credit, one of the great innovators of the last 40 years.
Oh, absolutely.
And Michael Dell did it with computers, of course. Steve Jobs and Tim Cook at Apple, Bill Gates at Microsoft, and the list goes on. Tesla with Elon Musk. I mean, the list goes on. There isn't a lack of entrepreneurs in America. I mean, they do a fabulous job of getting things to the people. And if the people say no, they either have to change or they go out of business. And that's been the history of the auto companies, the airlines. And look at all the retailers that have gone out of business the last 20 years.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, my goodness, living up north, there are retailers that were iconic retailers in the New York metropolitan region. They're no longer around. And
Well,
we're seeing.
I was just reading just the other day about the fact that people forget this. In 2008, only 15 years ago, Sears was the biggest company, right, retail company in the world. And in like 10
Kmart,
years, it went
Radio
away.
Shack. I mean, these
Yeah.
are iconic companies that have been around for decades. And then you had Montgomery Ward was a big company at one
Right.
time. John Wanamaker, I don't know where they were throughout the country, but they were certainly in the Northeast. That's where they
Yeah.
were based, in Philadelphia. So again, Filene's from Boston, the discount store. They were the iconic store in Boston. They were in New Jersey. We used to go there all the time. Cy Sims, his retail stores in the New York metropolitan region. It just goes on and on and on. I mean, you could do a whole book on companies that are no longer around. It'd
Yeah.
probably be as big as companies that were created over the last 40, 50, 70 years.
Yeah, the you could. So I'm getting back to what you're just saying though, about the government. It sounds like you kind of do agree with me that you can't print so much fake money and not have something bad happen at some
Well, it's
point.
happened throughout history. I mean, I've been writing about this for 50 years now.
Yeah,
It's
right.
since the 1970s. So this has been going on even before Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. And we're reaching the day of reckoning, because right now there's no constraint on the Federal Reserve in terms of its printing money, except the inflation. So when the inflation accelerated in 2022, that's when they started raising interest rates, because they realized that politically and economically, it's untenable to have inflation running at 8-9% a year. And inflation has come down from 9% down to 4%. But still, 4% means that prices are doubling every, what, 15 years, 17 years, the rule of 72. So
Well, I know it's a, I know it's kind of like a perfect storm, but I do the shopping for my family, and realistically, in the last 12 months, most of the stuff in the supermarket has gone up 50%. At least here where I live in the upper Midwest, you know?
Yeah, well, the nice thing about where we are, there's a lot of competition. We've got Publix, you've got the Aldi's, you've got Costco, you've got Walmart.
Well, we got all that stuff too. As a matter of fact, I mean, we're known for really great supermarkets around here. So,
well, the thing is, to be a good shopper, I mean, we get the weekly flyer from Publix every week, and they have their 2-for-1 sale, buy one, get one free. So if there are things that we use and it's buy one, get one free, we stock up with as much as possible if it's a non-perishable item. And that's how you save a lot of money over the course of a year. The same thing with Costco, when they have their sales every month, if there are things that we buy that are off 10, 20%, whatever the case may be, you just stock up, and that's how you can save a lot of money. I used to make a count of how much we saved on this, and it could add up to several thousand dollars a year.
Oh yeah, yeah.
If you're really prudent in what you're buying,
I mean, Walmart figures that if you shop at Walmart exclusively, you probably save $1,500 a year. And that's probably a realistic figure. You know, probably is. You know,
I mean, this is why you got to be very prudent. If you have a family of four and you're making $60,000-$70,000, which is not a lot of money in America these days, you've got to really stretch your dollars. And there are ways of doing it by shopping when the stores have their sales. And you can go to thrift shop for clothing, or you go to these discount places like the Nordstrom Rack, which is a bit more upper end. But TJ Maxx, people go to TJ Maxx and other places like that. Well, you can get good quality merchandise for a pretty good discount. So again, what I see, and it's also in the data, automobile insurance has skyrocketed about, I don't know, 18% the last year.
Yeah, that's right.
That's because of all the storms we've had. We had the hurricane in Florida a year and a half ago. We've had the tornadoes and fires were all over the place. So these are the things that drive up automobile insurance, which is pretty hefty all over the country now. I mean, we have one car, and I think we're paying $1,800, $2,000 a year. And the company that we have the insurance with, they're leaving the state of Florida. So we got to find another insurance company in a couple of months. So again, the insurance market not a great business model, because when there is a natural disaster and they have to shell out so much money, will the regulators, since insurance is regulated by state insurance people, will they be able to raise the rates in order to make sure that they can pay future benefits and have a profit for the shareholders?
So, Murray, this is on my list here, and you have to. I'm hoping you can educate both me and the viewers. What is referred to as M2? What is M2 money?
M2, I don't have the definition in front of me, but it's basically cash, checking account, money market account, savings accounts, just about everything that of liquid assets that we have that people can use to pay their bills. So it's right now, M2 is around 20-some-odd trillion. I think it's 20 trillion, $18 trillion. And it's skyrocketed since 2019 during COVID. The money supply in 2020 grew by 25%. So a tremendous amount of money was created. That money sloshing around. It drove up real estate prices. It drove up stock prices. Real estate interest rates on mortgages went down to 3%. So people were loading up on housing and condos all across the country. I remember getting an email from a woman who must have heard me speak somewhere. And she's a retiree. She says, thinking of buying a condo. And I think rates were 3% at the time. I said, if you're going to live here long term, lock in a 3% mortgage rate, because I've never seen that in my lifetime, a 3% mortgage rate. And so hopefully she did that. So the M2 money supply is something that economists look at, not all of them, but some of them, to see exactly what the future trend of inflation will be and how that could impact economic activity. And what's been happening with M2, it's actually been shrinking. And historically, when the money supply shrinks, you tend to get not only a recession, but you tend to have prices coming down as well, because there isn't enough money to support the price level of a lot of these goods and services. So we'll see what happens in 2024. But with the tensions in the Middle East, people are nervous about a shooting war where we may be involved in. And so you see the price of gold above $2,000. And there could be a big flight into commodities as people start saying, hey, I better get hold of these commodities if I need it in my production process. Or just speculators saying, hey, there may be a supply disruption because of the hostilities in the Red Sea. And so therefore the shipping costs will go up, and therefore that could be trigger higher prices for the consumer down the road. So we'll see what happens. We live in very difficult times, to say the least.
This is the reason I actually brought this up, Murray, is because I've been reading that the amount of M2 is also signifying the fact we're going to have a major recession, and that's exactly what you're talking about. All right, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, we just don't know the exact timing of it. But right. When I wrote this piece for Fortune magazine in December of 21, I said, given everything we know now, this is how the economy should look 2 years from now. And I think my forecast will eventually play out, because with the money supply shrinking, the M2 money supply shrinking, and the stock market looks like it reached a temporary peak here, it looks like the economy is going to slow down. How much so, nobody can predict that with any accuracy. But the point is, all the pieces are in place for the economy to slow down in 2024, which the last time that happened was 2008. We know what happened.
Right.
Obama won the election.
So let me ask you something else I got on my list, and I don't know if we've ever talked about this before, and that's cryptocurrency. So first of all, can you explain? I don't understand exactly what's going on, that the SEC is going to start regulating like Bitcoin ETFs and that sort of thing. Am I right about that?
Well, the SEC gave approval for companies to issue ETFs, which is an exchange-traded fund, where what would be the assets that would be in the fund would be the different types of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum and others that are out there. I'm not an expert on by any means of this phenomenon. And my initial reaction is, you can't create a money out of nothing. It's really a speculative vehicle. It's had a huge run-up since it was first introduced, 10, 12 years ago. It reached a peak of 66,000, crashed down to, 18,000. Now it's back up to 43,000. Yeah. So if you're a speculator in crypto and you've been riding these waves, you've done quite well. I mean, I don't have any interest in doing that. So I just leave it to people who have more expertise in the crypto market. And there are predictions out there that crypto will reach well into the six figures in the years ahead. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's what some people believe in. And so I think the most prudent thing is to have a diversified stock portfolio, have some commodities like gold and silver in the portfolio, have some money in treasury bills or money market funds, and just ride the stock market wave, because for young people, the next 40, 50 years, the economy is going to grow. The stock market should do extremely well, and then have your insurance policy in gold and silver, and then have some cash to pick up some bargains if the stock market has a correction like it
did. I got to admit, Murray, I've been following this crypto thing for 15 years. I'm a computer programmer. I think it's nuts. It's like, well, first of all, it's neither a currency nor a commodity, especially Bitcoin particularly, because most people don't realize this. There's only a certain finite amount of Bitcoin that can exist mathematically. So the thing is, it's not like a currency where you can ebb and flow the money supply. Once they've mined all the Bitcoin, it's done. And it doesn't do anything. So what are you actually investing in, you know? But it's easy for me to sit here and think everyone's crazy. And of course, then people are making millions of dollars.
Well, Warren Buffett and his late partner, Charlie Munger, were very critical of crypto, and they're pretty smart fellows. The point is, in order for something to be a money, a currency, it has to be accepted as a medium of exchange. And that's not happening with crypto or the other the cryptocurrencies out there, Bitcoin,
right,
and that. So again, this is basically a speculative vehicle. that people trade. And if you can make money on it, great. If you lose money, so be it. That's what speculation is all about. There are winners and losers. And so we'll see how this plays out. But the main thing is we're all dollar-centric. We use dollars. We get paid in dollars. We pay our bills in dollars. And that's what we use. And right now, the dollar is probably going to be under pressure overseas because Russia, China, and other countries don't want to hold too many dollars because of the sanctions that the government, the federal government imposes on countries that use dollars.
Right.
For political reasons. So I think long term, the dollar will decline in value and it could be quite substantial. And that's why I think the price of gold could have a big substantial rise over the next several years as well.
Do you think there's any chance that the Chinese will ever actually be able to substitute the yuan for dollars as default currency anywhere? It seems like they want to do that.
Yeah, I think the only way that I think they can do it is if they get together with the other BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, and the other countries that have joined and say, listen, we're going to back our currencies with gold. So it's not going to be inflated. It's not going to be manipulated. It's going to have a strong purchasing power to everyone wants their currency to have strong purchasing power because you can buy more stuff with a strong currency. And if they do that, then it's a game changer because then what's the United States going to do given that people have more confidence in a what if they call it the BRICS? Here's the BRICS.
Yeah.
It's going to be a unit weight of gold.
Right.
Whatever that unit weight of gold is. And they create a major alternative to the dollar. And that would have enormous repercussions because what if the OPEC nations start trading in quote BRICS backed by gold, and then the dollar will be in less demand. Less demand means it loses its value, and then we have a real problem in the United States. So what they need to do is whoever's the next president should call an international monetary conference and say, listen, we want prosperity around the world. We want trade around the world. We want people to experience the benefits of a market economy. And so we need to have a sound financial monetary system in order to do that. Let's get to work in creating one. And we can go back to a Bretton Woods type system where the dollar was defined as 1/35th of an ounce of gold. Right now, the dollar would have to be defined at some astronomical number because so many dollars have been created since 1944 when the Bretton Woods system was put together. So that's 80 years. And it would have to be a lot of these technocrats in the monetary arena who could advise governments on what's the best course of action. But right now, I don't see any indication that's going to happen. But I think the BRICS phenomenon could be the impetus for the United States, the UK, Germany, France, to get together and say, let's come up, Italy, come up with a monetary system that is going to be sustainable because we don't have a sustainable monetary system now.
Yeah. Murray, what do you got coming up?
What do I got coming up? Well, I had an interesting session today with a gentleman, international attorney based in the Bahamas who has a website called Clout Hub, C-L-O-U-T, hub.com. And there's a possibility I may be doing podcasts and offering courses on there. Plus, next week, we hope to begin offering our Economics of Healthcare and Wellness, Economics of Healthcare and Wellness online at ipec-edu.org. And we're very excited about the potential for this course to start putting ideas in people. People's heads, especially the policymakers, that there's a better way of having medical care in this country than the current system that they've created over the past 50, 75 years.
Have they created that system to help the medical community make money?
What they've done is basically caused the doctor-patient relationship to take backseat to big pharma, big insurance companies, and big government.
That's what I meant, right. Yeah.
Restore the doctor-patient relationship, and that means that people have to look at alternatives which are out there in terms of direct primary care, cost-sharing organizations, whether it's a Christian-oriented or a or secular-oriented sharing organization. There are many ways of having sound medical care without government or big insurance companies involved.
And you're an expert on this, so let me ask you this too. Do you think that there seems to be perception among the public now that that big medicine isn't interested in curing anything, but rather treating it because there's more money in treatment than cures? Is that
There's no question about it. That's why one doctor who created Forward, which is a direct primary care outfit, they have locations around the country, and I think they're creating more of them. He says, we don't have healthcare in this country, we have sick care. Basically, doctors should be helping people stay healthy so they don't have to see a doctor. Instead, the doctors basically have, because of insurance and Medicare and Medicaid, they basically have a cash cow in these organizations. Of course, that's been limited to some degree in most recent years. But doctors should be in the forefront of helping people stay healthy with recommendations that naturopaths and others do in terms of supplements and correct eating habits and lifestyle. And instead, the American people are getting more and more obese, even though we're people are on low-fat diets and all the other things that we're told we should be doing. And so don't believe the government food pyramid. That's been wrong for decades.
Yeah, I know that. Right, it has, yeah.
So we need to have a discussion of what's the problem, how did we get there, and what are the benefits of alternatives to the current system?
Yeah, now I think you sent me some links on this, and I'm going to put them up on our blog tomorrow. So we'll.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I can't thank you enough. And I love having you on here because you answer these questions and you know so much. And I think it's really good that the viewers actually and the public actually learn some of this shit. Oh, and it just occurred to me too when I said that. I hope you don't think I was trying to put words in my mouth when I said that. I've had a friend of mine that says you're nuts. I really do. A friend of mine told me he watched the show you're on, and he said, so that wasn't me, that was him. But he
listen, I've been called a lot worse, so that's okay.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I figured you were really used to it at this point, so you know. But the thing is, I basically agree with you. I can't see how you can print so much fake money and not have anything bad happen. I just don't see how, you know, at some point there has to be a reckoning, doesn't there? I mean,
absolutely. This has happened throughout American history. It's since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, we've had depressions, great recessions, recession because the Fed has pumped money into the system, manipulated interest rates, and it always ends very poorly. And we're going to see that happen again. Now, I don't know if this is going to be the real big one, but the Fed still has another rabbit to pull out of the hat. They can lower interest rates to try to stimulate the economy when the next downturn occurs, which should happen very soon, I think.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. And we'll have you on in probably another eight weeks to talk about it again. So thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You take care. We'll see you. Take care.
Bye now.
That's Murray Sabrin, economist extraordinaire. He's the professor emeritus of economics at Ramapo College in New Jersey. And he also started the Sabrin Center for Free Enterprise there, too. He's been around a lot. He's written five books. His books are on our blog at jimandnight.com. If you want to check that out, you might have to go back to like kind of the beginning, but the blog's not that long yet. So I got a couple of things to end with here too. You know, we usually kind of keep this as the C block, and we usually kind of put some of the more unusual news at the end. First of all, I thought this was really interesting. So the Golden Globes were last week or the week before, I can't remember. Joe Coy was the MC. He was roundly panned, and most people never heard of this guy. I had. He's a pretty good comedian, but his MC, Master of Ceremonies duties were roundly panned by like everybody. His monologue bombed. You know, but on the other hand, and this is really, you know, Kevin Hart said after that, he said he felt for Joe Coy and that, And the problem is like those people in that room, very, very wealthy actors and actresses, and very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? They are entitled, but they're catered to. They don't have very good senses of humor anymore. I think you go back 50, 60 years, 60s and 70s, you know. Well, first of all, there's two things that happened there, and that is celebrities years ago were significantly older than they are now. So you have people with a little more perspective. And also, a lot of them fought in World War II. And so, you know, that changes your perspective on life, too. They were coddled is the word I was looking for. Celebrities years ago were nowhere near as coddled as they are now. And Hart was saying, well, these people don't really have much of a sense of humor. They don't want to laugh at themselves, which is really unfortunate. But the reason I'm bringing up this Golden Globe thing is that, so, you know, they have swag bags. Pretty much everybody who comes to the event, you know, and Hollywood's famous for this, you get a bag of stuff, free stuff, you know, that people that just for showing up, you know, it's kind of like a courtesy sort of thing. The swag bag, the contents of the swag bag at the Golden Globes was worth over $500,000 per bag. Now, I'm not talking about all the bags. I'm talking about per bag. It was about $550,000. There were yacht rentals in there, all sorts of stuff that you would just absolutely not believe. So, yeah. So, everyone who showed up at the event basically got $500,000 in free stuff. That didn't really make the news. That's one of the things I like to talk about here, is stuff that didn't make the news. And then the other thing that's interesting, and this is actually kind of interesting to me personally for a reason I'll tell you right now, and that is there in the cemetery in Los Angeles where Marilyn Monroe is buried, she's in a crypt. She's not on the ground. She's in a mausoleum-type crypt. The crypt next to hers is being sold for $440,000. Now, the reason this is personal for me is because when I lived in Los Angeles years ago, literally years ago, 35, 40 years ago, one night, a bunch of friends of mine and I, we got drunk and we busted into that cemetery. I have vivid memories of this. And there's a whole bunch of celebrities that are buried in that cemetery. But though, basically the main one is Marilyn Monroe. That's the one everybody wants to see. And I still remember in the middle of the night, that cemetery, now it's called, I think it's called the Pierce Brothers Cemetery. It's gone, it's changed names, I think maybe a dozen times in the last 40 years. So it's like, you know, it keeps getting bought and sold, whatever, you know, I think it was called the Hollywood Forever Cemetery for a while, something like that. And that might be now the one that's next to Paramount Pictures, whatever. The thing is, it's in Westwood. And so, yeah, we broke into it. And there were staring at Marilyn Monroe's crypt. It was kind of, we didn't break into the crypt. No, no, no. No, I'm just saying it's like we broke into the grounds. We broke into the cemetery itself. And we were drunk and we were happy and young. You know, what can I tell you? You know, I was young once. I know you might have a hard time believing that, but it's true. But anyway, yeah, so there's the whoever owns the crypt next to hers, they're selling it for $440,000 because you get to be buried next to Marilyn Monroe. Yeah, okay. All right, fine. So tomorrow night, David Strom's going to be here. We always have a great time talking to him. I mean, the problem is we can talk to him forever. So it's like I literally got to cut ourselves off. So, and we're pre-recording that in the afternoon. We're pre-taping that. I had a light fail in here. Holy shit. That's not good. Okay. And yeah, because, you know, it took us like 2 months to figure out the lighting in here. And the general rule was more light. more is better. So yeah. And we got David Strom on Tuesday, tomorrow night. Wednesday night, the dynamic duo of Jennifer Oliver O'Connell and Jeff Meyer. Jennifer from RunState.com. Jeff Meyer from Conk.com, and on Thursday, Stan Gordon, the UFO researcher. And that should be really interesting. I've had interesting just talking to him on the phone, setting this up. He told me some things that I thought were true weren't. So, and we'll talk to him about that. So I want to thank you for watching. I really appreciate this a lot. I really do. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. We'll see you tomorrow night. Take care.